Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Through expert interviews, we help you navigate the challenges of leading, hiring, growing, and nurturing your tech team to deliver the value your customers demand. Brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally.
Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for leaders of growing software engineering teams. I'm Aaron Syme, along with my co-host, David Alfaro. David, this is our 10th podcast episode together after working for over 10 years together leading Agility Feet. And so keeping with that theme, how are you feeling today on a scale of 1 to 10?
10.
10.
And the reason it is 10 is... it's not only it matches with the amount of episodes that we are now having, and that's good. But and the other thing about the 10 is that it really tells about the milestone by itself. It's a great milestone for us.
Yeah,
this process of trying to launch the podcast is not easy for anyone. It's not easy. So getting to 10 is a great applause to all the team behind us as well.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Yes, definitely. Yeah. And it is a bit of a milestone. And so we're doing something a little bit different in this episode. Instead of having a guest today, we're going to review some of our favorite quotes or kind of learning lessons learned from our first 9 episodes. So you could think of this as our version of a retrospective within the podcast. We talk about agile methods regularly on the Scaling Tech Podcast. And so as our listeners probably know already, retrospectives are meant to be frequent and short reviews of what a team has learned, what has gone well in the last iteration, in the last sprint, what can they improve, and so on. So we're going to do something similar about every 10 episodes of the Scaling Tech Podcast and just review the lessons learned from our guests. And so if you are curious to learn more about any of these guests that we mentioned in this episode, just go back to scalingtechpod.com anytime, and you can see the show notes and watch the full episode for all of these. So we're going to sort of skip over episode 1. That was our origin story. There was no guest. It was you and I talking about our experiences together. And so if you're interested in learning more about the journey that David and I have been on, that's the one to listen to, right?
Although I am inclined to suggest an episode just for anecdotes.
Yes.
At some point. That will be fun at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we certainly included plenty of, some anecdotes and funny stories about how we met and how we got to this point today. So it's a great way to get to know us, certainly. Mm-hmm. But we're going to move on to episode 2 with noted Kanban expert, Dan Vacanti. And Dan spoke with us about a wide range of Kanban topics. But let's go to this quote first from Dan about choosing between Scrum and Kanban, or rather, that you don't have to choose between Scrum and Kanban.
But this is why I say, in my mind, it's imperative probably to do both, or at least explore how you might do. I don't know how you do Scrum without Kanban. And to be honest with you, if you're doing Kanban, I don't know how you do Kanban without things like, let's make sure we're checking everything, checking in every day to make sure we're progressing toward a goal. Let's make sure our team is getting together and talking about how we can improve. Let's make sure that we're meeting with our stakeholders regularly to review, our progress toward maybe, wider product goals and things. And it starts sounding a lot like Scrum at that point, so that, that's what I'm saying. I think the lines really, really start to blur. Once you start thinking about it that way.
So David, what did you think about our conversation with Dan?
That conversation was about the core principles of Agile. So I really like the way it went. We covered essential aspects of Kanban and why it's different when you compare it with Scrum. And the more we talked about that, the less conflict we found. I mean, there are differences, absolutely, but philosophically, we found that we could even have an environment where we are implementing both or parts of each at the same time. And I found that very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah, we covered a lot. And it is interesting because Dan is known primarily as a Kanban trainer, but, you know, hearing him talk about the balance of Scrum and Kanban, I also enjoy the conversation with him about estimation, how much he hates story points, you know, mm-hmm. common thing we talk about in Scrum, and his emphasis instead is about the way he described it, really was probabilistic statements about the future and how measuring flow helps us to do that. So yeah, lots of really interesting stuff in that episode. Now in our next episode, episode 3 with Sanjeev Augustine, we talked about managing for value delivery. And Sanjeev is a thought leader in agile leadership. And one of the many interesting points he made in this conversation is about how the pandemic has accelerated the demise of the project model. And that's why we need to learn to manage for value instead of managing a project. So let's hear what Sanjeev had to say about the definition of a value management office.
Let's start with the work that needs to be done in today's environment. You know, things have changed radically over the last 2 or 3 years. What has happened with the onset of the pandemic is an acceleration, if you will, of the demise of the project model. And when I say project model, it's also associated with the waterfall model, where we have large batches. We go through requirements, analysis, design, development, test, and we have customers left out of that cycle, and we have crappy products, we build the wrong thing, and dissatisfied customers. Now, not all of that is the fault of the project model, but modern day product development and modern day even project management drives us in the direction of small batch delivery, tightly coupled with customer-centric design, customer-centric delivery, right? So the work for management in this environment is to support small agile teams that are working in close collaboration with their customers. So for us, value management then becomes, what can we do as leaders at the level above the teams? If we're indeed enabling our teams or supporting our teams, our agile teams, of course, what do we need to do, right? And so it boils down to a combination of some lean portfolio management and some adaptive governance. That's what we call managing value. Lean portfolio management, managing the funnel of work that's going to the teams, and then adaptive governance, which is making sure that we have the appropriate controls in place, the teams are supported, and our organizations are supported with the appropriate controls. So with that lens, lean portfolio management and adaptive governance, we look at the existing constructs, and the existing construct is usually a PMO, a project management office. And we say, well, how can PMOs or middle management support this new model? And that becomes the transition from here's a project model with a PMO to here's a value management model with a value management office. And typically, there's a transition involved when the PMO no longer becomes the gatekeeper or process police. But now the people in the PMO, the value managers, now become enablers of an agile adoption, an agile transformation, and of the agile mindset.
So David, what did you think about this concept of managing for value delivery?
It's exactly what all the Lean Revolution was about. I mean, like several years ago, but Sanjeev is doing something interesting. He's giving more structure to it and allowing companies to adopt that procedure. I mean, that way of thinking, that value first. I mean, mm-hmm. It is not projects for the sake of projects. It's we are doing this product for the sake of the value that we are delivering to the customers. And the framework that he establishes is very natural. And I want to emphasize this, and very respectful of and I'm sorry, mindful of the current organizational structures in big companies.
Yes.
So it's very nice. Very nice. I think it makes sense. And I want to say something else. During that episode, we were mentioning all the COVID post situation. I mean, the post-pandemic situation. And we are now entering in a very complicated situation as well. Or we already still, and we don't know the end of it yet.
Right.
All the economic pressures that also is going along with the talent scarcity pressures that the market is suffering. So
yeah,
all of these pressures are forcing companies more and more to focus on the value delivery process instead of projects for the sake of projects.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, we don't really have time or the available talent to just do stuff because it's the way we did business in the past, or you know, it's a project that's been sitting on a backlog or something like that. We really need to focus on what is the value that our customers need. So yeah, that's a great point, David. And yeah, this episode with Sanjeev was really interesting and giving us a framework for around that. Now, let's move on to episode 4 with our old friend Dave Hafner and talking about his journey of moving from being a QA to a software developer. And this was a really fun conversation. He's worked in a wide variety of roles, from QA to test automation and Selenium consultant, and now as a software developer. We talked with him about that journey. And one part of the discussion that I particularly enjoyed were his comments about using North Stars and anchors as a way to tackle difficult problems or when you're working on a large legacy application.
For me, I guess the thing that I really embraced over time was that when things just seem kind of unbounded and super challenging and hard to really make progress on, I always find that you want to look for the constraints. And those actually, to me, well, initially they, some of them felt very frustrating. They kind of feel like a warm, like a nice balm, like something that's really helpful in terms of like having a North Star. Like you find your horizon. There's a constraint. It's like if it actually is an immovable thing, either it's something that's imposed by the business, something that's imposed by the technology, and then from there you have an anchor, something that's a good cornerstone that you're able to then orient from. And for me, that's like the backdrop of everything I brought in with this perspective of all these learnings, plus like the reconciliation usually comes down to, you know, acknowledging I work in kind of a ludicrous version of software development is what it feels like. I mean, I'm constantly surprised every week, and I feel like I've seen everything, and then I'm constantly challenged by what I see in my job in terms of how people use the software that we have, and like, and the list goes on. And so for me, it's always, okay, but what's the constraint? And then also the other one is what's changed. Like usually something breaks and you don't understand why. And there's usually at least a half dozen different things in the tech stack that I work in that could cause that to happen. So it's, you know, for me, it's coming back to these, like, what are these simple fundamentals? Like, it's really nice, these great ideas that these practitioners who wrote these things down talk about. And then, and they're able to typically summarize it into something nice. And at the time with the problems they were working on and the technologies they were using, these are great applicable things. And then you end up in your circumstance and it might not be the same. So for me, I'm always like trying to distill it down to something that's more at like an atomic level. And it's like, what's changed and what are the constraints? And then from there, work my way back up, try to find the in-between between like, that's what the book said, and then this is what reality is showing me. Okay, but here is gravity. Here is gravity in this situation. Okay, which way is up? Okay, let's work up from there.
David, working, whether you're testing or writing the software, working on any large legacy application is so complicated. And I like some of the metaphors that Dave was using in this conversation. As you think about what are the constraints that you have to work in while fixing this problem. And it's not always as simple as, you know, maybe a design pattern book might tell you it should be if you're building it from scratch, right? So what did you think about these North Stars and anchors, and how do you deal with constraints in a complicated application?
It was a very interesting conversation. It was a very philosophical conversation, actually. Because it's about knowledge. It's about the theory of knowledge. How do we form concepts from a perspective, from the perspective of a software engineer? Yeah. So the clip was very philosophical. I mean, actually epistemological, in the sense that how do we come up with concepts? And when he mentions problems, is okay. How can we construct this concept in our minds and then in software? What are the constraints that we have to respect, because that's the reality.
Right.
So we respect reality, and the realities tell us either the business has these constraints or the technology has huge constraints. So that the process of how to systematize the birth of a solution is a complicated topic.
Yeah.
It is soft, and Dave was fantastic. I love Dave. I love him very much in the sense that he is crafty.
Yes.
This was the crafty episode. Very, very crafty. And you can see a man on his craft.
Right.
You talk with Dave. So basically my takeaways are respect reality, either business of business requirements of technological constraints, technological constraints, and then find a way, then understand the situation from a theoretical point of view, and then trying to reconcile those things and work your way up until the conclusion, the solution. So yeah, how you tame chaos.
Right.
So Dave was very good at that.
How to tame chaos. Exactly. That'll be his book title someday.
Right.
Now, speaking of taming chaos and continuing a theme of project management or product management, in episode 5, we had a very nice conversation with one of my grad school professors, Professor Ryan Nelson from the University of Virginia, about the classic mistakes and infamous failures of project management. And there are so many of them. Not only are there lots of infamous failures, but we also lamented with Professor Nelson about how many projects are still failing now. And we talked about some ideas for how you can improve that failure rate with agile methods and other things. And one thing that Professor Nelson brought up, which I really appreciate, is something similar to what Sanjeev said in episode 3. He talked about we should be thinking less about project management and more about product management instead, and that's what the most innovative companies are doing. So let's hear more of what Ryan had to say.
And they also have, like a lot of progressive companies have done, is even push further than that into a complete change in mindset from project to product. And that has really kind of broken the cycle of the annual planning and budgeting cycle. So Capital One is a great example of one of the companies that have really started to figure out that, you know, just trying to do the planning cycles on a couple of week basis for projects wasn't enough. That was really more of a general mindset that was required.
So David, based on our conversation with Professor Nelson and our experience over so many years, how would you recommend our listeners avoid their projects becoming an infamous failure?
The biggest concern in doing software is risk management. At the end of the day, is to clarify that is uncertainty. How do I deal with uncertainty? How do I reduce the uncertainty? Because the fact is, just uncertainty is going to be there always. So how I come to terms with it,
and right.
And agility and the agile framework is all about that. When you're starting a project, a product, as per we've been discussing.
That's right. We're doing products now, not projects.
Right. When you start a product, then you start thinking, I mean, what are the most risky things about the project? And at the beginning, they are very clear. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, everything is risky. So it's the core risky things about the product are always all the integrations. So making software by itself is very easy. I mean, that part is not that it's not complicated, actually. What is complicated is when you connect what you're doing as a software developer with existing things.
Yes.
That's the part when everything breaks loose, when everything is unpredictable.
Yeah.
So for that, we love to use the concept of walking skeleton, which is a process. It's a process of a risk discovery management. Mm-hmm. So we reduce uncertainty. In that walking skeleton, we establish the thinnest definition of the product using another concept called a vertical slice of the product, which specifies the minimum functionality of the entire product that forces developer that forces developer to go through all the integration points, be it databases, being APIs, being other parts of the systems in different clouds. I mean, all the things mm-hmm. that need to be connected, all the things that need to be connected to the product. So those things, those connection points, and for that we also use the hexagonal architecture as well. We define those things, so we can isolate all the connection points, and then we establish a vertical slice, which is a definition of the product that covers those points. And we take that is very, very, is thin, but it's complicated. It's highly complicated. it is like with thorns, and it's very easy to get an accident in that situation. So we throw that to the developers so they can deal with those unknowns that are the riskiest as soon as possible. With that process, we are going to discover all the unknowns, all the uncertainties, all the hidden rocks.
Yeah.
And then whatever huge problem that we didn't see in the planning, we are going to discover. We are going to discover it there in that process. Yeah. And that way we start dealing with what are the next important thing that we're assuming. And then, but at the same time, how can we move towards the completion of the project in a prioritized way? So that marriage of what is the thing that is more important in terms of value for the customer, along with the what is the next risky thing that we're assuming, so he can tackle that first. That process is going to help us to tame in this other way, in from the product management perspective, the chaos, the uncertainty, and for that you need very smart people. I mean, managing the team, but also the developers and people that are really smart and they can flexible and they can adapt, because you're going to discover things every single week at the beginning. But the nice thing, just to close the thought, is you will discover that it is so painful at the beginning, but as you go through this process, it's less and less painful. So the fantastic thing is that you're going to end the project on time, with a high percentage of predictability.
Yeah.
Compare that with the traditional way.
Right, exactly.
It's the opposite, right?
Right, exactly. And I mean, ideally you would do, to the degree that you're going to do estimates, or as Dan Vacanti would say, probabilistic statements about the future, to the degree that we're going to do that, we would do that after the walking skeleton process as much as possible, or at least refine them, maybe even revisit contract terms if necessary after that, if that's involved. Because now, ideally, you have tested all of those integration points. You've tested those external APIs you're working with, and maybe your deployment mechanisms, your deployment architecture, all of those things. You've done some level of test of them through that walking skeleton, so that now you've got a strong technical basis, so that the rest of the time, hopefully you're less worried about that technical risk and more focused on delivery of value, as our guests have talked about. So, yeah. So speaking of external APIs and integration points and risk points that you might face in your technical architecture, a lot of times those integration points are going to be a commercial API from a SaaS provider, say someone like Twilio. And that's something we talked about in episode 6 with Matt McKay about the role of a developer evangelist. And Twilio, where Matt works, is an example of a company that does a great job with developer-focused APIs and content marketing. And Matt shared with us lessons that many companies could use if they're marketing to developers. But one point he made is very interesting for any engineering manager to consider, regardless of the type of company you work at, whether you're marketing to developers or not. Since you are still likely contracting with these various SaaS-based APIs to build your product, you need to decide who is worth your trust. You know, which APIs do you want to use? And Matt talked about how you can look at the quality of their developer relations program, the quality of the work that their developer evangelists do, to determine if you want to use their APIs, if you trust that.
You're an engineering manager at, you know, I don't know, an insurance company, and you're looking at using an API, and you're, you know, like, what do you care about, especially at companies that are, you know, more pragmatic about things and the adoption curve? You don't want to get fired for using some API that is insecure or not providing a good level of service, or just goes out of business for whatever reason and all of your applications stop working, right? So typically, as an engineering manager, you're going to want to look at those, engage with evangelists to just like ask them questions and kind of suss out, like, is this a company that is high quality? Do they really care about developers? You know, is this API actually the core of their business, or is it just kind of a side tangent, right? So some companies like Netflix had APIs for a long time that they got rid of. It wasn't their business, right? So if you built a whole company on Netflix's API, you don't have a business anymore. You know, like, it's gone. That's the type of thing as an engineering manager that you should be kind of sussing out, is like, is this a legitimate, like any sort of business that you're potentially going to be into, you know, contractual relationship with or something like that. As a supplier, you have to suss out, are they a valid supplier? Are they a good company to do business with? And particularly looking at it as like, should I stake my career on using this vendor or not?
So David, what did you learn from this episode with Matt McKay?
Several things, but two of them are the criteria you can use to determine if a third-party service API is going to be a good choice for you in the future. And what we discuss in this episode is that assessing how healthy is the developer relations program that third-party company is having, that the community that is behind that, and if that company is actually putting effort in taking care of the developers, because the developers are the actual final users of the API they are offering. And if for that company, that API is the core business. Brilliant. I think it is one important concern. I mean, besides the technicals, I mean, all the if the API is offering what I need in terms of requirements. But yeah, besides that, I think it's brilliant. I think is a good thing to take into account. How committed they are to make their product, which is the API, successful. Mm-hmm. How much they care. How responsive they are, how strong is the community around the API. Absolutely. The other thing I want to say that we touched briefly, but I think is very important to me, is the same criteria could be applied when you are already building an internal API, if you are building microservices. And if you don't give enough resources to care about the API, it's going to become something that few people are going to understand, and it's unusable. It's only used in some scenarios and not more. So maybe it's subutilized. That's happened. So although it is not the same, because internally you cannot. I mean, it is the API is not the direct product that we are selling necessarily. But the fact remains is the internal clients are the internal developers using the API, that API. So the documentation, people in charge of that, taking care of that, is at a different scale, but the point remains. I mean, how much you care about the things you're building internally for your internal people, I think is an important point.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if you're a leader in a enterprise IT organization, you probably have, you know, enough teams working on your systems that they don't know about everything going on in the overall enterprise architecture. Yeah. They don't know about every microservice in there. And that is, yeah, that's something Matt talked about in this episode too, that I thought was interesting, is the idea of like an internal evangelist within a company to popularize, to help coach people through using that internally. And yeah, then you don't have a whole bunch of orphaned microservices sitting around. So that was really interesting. And another part I enjoyed about this too, he talked about the importance of empathy and in hiring developer evangelists, because you need someone who can not only communicate technical ideas, but can also really relate to the user, relate to other developers. And I thought that was a really good point, really, really interesting point that really applies to hiring developers in general. So yeah, lots of good stuff in this episode with Matt. Episode 7, our next episode, was with another engineering leader. Very interesting technical conversation with noted extreme programming consultant and thought leader Bill Wake. And one of the topics I found very interesting in this episode is ensemble programming, which you could think of perhaps as like the next evolution of pair programming. So let's hear what Bill had to say about what is the definition of ensemble programming.
Well, Woody Zuhl at least popularized the technique that they developed at Hunter, where he was working. And it's the notion that you just get the whole team programming together. You have people take turns being the typist. And some people do it with a style where they have one person that's kind of designated as the voice of the team and kind of telling the typist what's next and so on. And the team may be, it may be just the programmers, it may be programmers in QA or user end of people too, customers of some sort. But anyway, working together, taking turns, rotating usually fairly quickly, but there's a lot of variation in how they do it. But the idea is to try and get the best of everybody's point of view rather than kind of whoever, you know, the person or two that's working there at one moment, their personal best might not be as good as the team best.
David, what did you enjoy about this conversation with Bill?
Again, it was crafty. I like crafty conversations. I mean, I enjoy seeing people that is great master of the craft. So yeah, it is a joy to see. And we traversed so many paths here, but one that was very interesting was the ensemble programming, which is an extension expansion on the pair programming methodology, where you have a driver, the typist, and then you have the other person. You have the typist, and then the other person is assisting you.
And you
change turns, and I mean to change the role. So and the whole point of pair programming in doing this is that you can get a back and forth, a wider perspective of the problem, and then you can come up with both with a better solution. And with ensemble programming is, let's involve the entire team. Why not? This is interesting because this touches an important point: collaboration. The expense, how costly collaboration is. Collaboration is expensive.
Sure.
So being very wise, it is expensive but very, very valuable. So determine what is the right moment to do a collaboration effort like this that is expensive depends on the complexity of the problem that you're dealing with. Right. So if you have a very, very delicate or complex problem that you have to fix because it's, something is there, or you want to come up with an idea of a solution, I think it's a great idea to do so. So what I'm trying to say is there are moments where maybe fixing small bugs, I don't know, changing the color of, I mean, the font of this part of the website, that, I mean, that doesn't make sense. And so that's an extreme.
Yeah.
And there's a spectrum of things, but in that spectrum of complexity and delicate things, there are moments where this kind of collaboration, like pair programming or ensemble programming or these kind of things, it's expensive, but the solution, I mean, the problem is expensive already. So it requires an expensive solution. And
right.
This is the best way to come up with a very good solution for this very complicated problem.
Yeah, yeah, I agree completely. It's interesting. I mean, it's easy as managers, as leaders, to say, oh, we have 10 people in this room and their hourly rate times 10.
Right.
Oh, this is such an expensive collaboration effort. It's easy to calculate the cost of collaboration. It's a lot harder to calculate the cost of not collaborating, right? Right. It's harder to calculate the cost of how long did that developer spend by themselves trying to solve this hard problem and not talking to anybody. And, you know, they may have spent more than 10 hours doing that, right? The cost may be much higher. And it's hard to quantify those things. I thought this was such an interesting topic, and I want to explore it more and learn more about it myself personally. I think it's hard to imagine doing this all time, full time with your whole team. But I think around specific problems and challenges and core parts of the architecture, I think it's a really interesting way to, maybe something more engaging than, you know, like the old idea of doing like a brown bag lunch where somebody talks about a technical topic or something they just built. That's fine. Those are still valuable too, but maybe mixing those up with sessions like this where, hey, we're just going to take a story together and work together as a team on it, I think is really interesting. So yeah, lots of great stuff in this episode with Bill Wake. Now in episode 8, we talked with a senior leader in our own team, Mariana Lopez, who David and I have worked with for over a decade now. She's become a business and technology leader in our organization, but her roots are in UX design. And so we spoke with her about how to hire UX and visual designers, especially if, like David and myself, you're not a designer. So yeah, I don't know what to ask a designer. I know how to do an interview with a developer, but not necessarily a designer. But here's one interview question that Mariana shared with us for interviewing designers I thought was really, really good. So let's hear what Mariana has to say.
I always ask about process. I ask some technical questions, and then I always ask them, tell me about a time that something got built that you didn't think was the best experience. And then I want to understand why they felt it got built, even though it wasn't the best experience. What did they try to do to persuade, and how did they know it wasn't the best experience, and what they did afterward? We've all been in situations as UX designers where, you know, budget restrictions, time restrictions, development restrictions, right? What you wanted couldn't be done. And so how did you navigate those constraints to come up with something that you were at least, you know, comfortable putting out to production? Or even if that didn't happen, how did you fix that later? And I tend to look for people that say, I understood that business wanted this. I tried to push back with these kinds of informations. But then in the end, this is what got built. This is how we changed it afterwards. Instead of people that say, oh yeah, I put up my designs, but they chose to do something different. You know, those are the people that you don't want as a team player, because in the end, it's going to happen, right? Sometimes what you design is not going to be what comes out there. I mean, honestly, unless I'm really lucky, most of the time that's not really unlucky. That's not how it happens, and it evolves. And you test it with users and you learn some things different. And that's what I want. I want designers and UX that can take critique, that can learn, and that can continue to grow and build upon what was already done.
David, Mariana has been a key part of our work for so long that I know it's hard to give just one answer to this question, but what else did you enjoy about this episode with her?
Yeah, something that is very distinctive about Mariana is she is very clear on let's be intentional about the decisions we're making. Yes. So if as a and this applies for every career, but in the specific example that we were exploring is what if you're a visual designer, a human interaction computer designer expert, and then you come up with a good solution, and then you show that solution to the customer, and the customer behaves very dismissive about the design and just cut corners, and is making the the someone in the business is making the decisions about not offering the best solution that the expert in the area is proposing. So how do you deal with that? And that happens right. Again if you are an architect. If you're, in every profession, you face situations like this.
Absolutely,
it's and from the perspective of the expert, it could be hard, but it is very helpful to do what she does.
Yeah,
she wants to understand what is the reason of the pushback.
Right,
is a personal choice. Is because you dislike me, or you dislike, justify the pushback. Just make it clear. Like we talk with Harpy. So let's name the situation.
Exactly.
I won't get offended. Just tell me why, right? And if it is not personal opinion, but maybe it's a wrong conclusion, okay, let's navigate the conclusion. Maybe I wasn't good enough in explaining why this is a good point.
Right.
So it is being so dismissive about the artwork that you do as a professional is not healthy for you.
Right.
Although Mariana is very particular and she's so good at framing the conversations and being very and giving very good arguments and getting away with her points, she's very good at that. But that's the merit of her intelligence and how he manages conversations, difficult conversations. But yeah, if you make the business decision of this miss where I'm proposing, that's okay, that's on you, but let's be clear why.
Yeah, absolutely. Like yeah definitely. And it's one of the harder things about like agile methods in general, I think, is that there's kind of this trade-off between the roles. And if we loosely think of it as a compromise, let's say, between business and technology teams, what we're kind of, as technology teams, we're asking for more autonomy than traditional ways of working. We're asking to make the technical decisions ourselves because we're the technical experts, right? And we're asking for more autonomy in how we build things and how and having more input on what we build and that sort of thing. But we're also sort of conceding a little bit to the business side that, hey, you all, you don't get to like make the estimates or drive the technology architecture, but you do know the customers really well, or you know the business use case really well. And so ultimately you get to kind of prioritize things. That's one of the biggest powers that like a product owner has in a Scrum team, right? And sometimes that means that whether you're a developer or a designer, you have a great idea about the application and anything from, maybe it's a design aspect to a new feature that the business says, yeah, that's a cool idea, but we're not going to do that right now. And to a degree, we have to be okay with that as a team, right? So that's part of that skill set that Mariana is looking for with that interview question, as a designer who's not just going to throw down their artwork and storm away. They're going to be a team member and say, okay, I understand that right now, this is the more important thing for us to work on. But here's the value of what I'm proposing, and maybe we can come back to that later. Maybe we can do this incrementally, right? So you start to have those sorts of conversations that really are a hallmark of collaboration, I think, and teamwork. So David, you made a reference to our next episode, episode 9 with Lisa Adkins, where we talked about agile coaching and one of the skills that she has and talked about in that episode of sort of naming the situation, which I think is a cool part of that episode also. If these first 9 and now 10 episodes of the Scaling Tech Podcast, if we call this our first season of the Scaling Tech Podcast, then I have to say we brought in an excellent closer in Lisa Adkins. She's a thought leader in agile coaching and agile transformation. And in this clip that I'm going to play next, she was actually talking with us about how she chooses a good client to work with for her as an agile coach. Work, you know, what is a good client for her to work with, who's kind of ready to work with her essentially. But this also, I think, provides a lot of insight to engineering leaders listening to this podcast. If you're thinking about hiring an agile coach for your team, for your organization across many teams, these points that Lisa makes are really interesting about some things that you might want to consider before you hire that agile coach about why are you doing this? Why do you want that major agile transformation?
The telltale sign I'm looking for is, do they have a vision for the change they want to make? Like, why is this change they want to make important to them? And is it a vision that's grounded in something that will sort of pull them forward through the hard times? So for some leadership teams, for some organizations, that why, the answer to that why, has to be grounded in business metrics and levers we want to pull and changes we want to see and these statistics by this certain time, because that's how that organization thinks. Some organizations, it could be that they want to be pulled forward by creating greater capacities in their organizations, greater capabilities among their people. So either of those could be good opportunities. Now, the next step beyond the why. So by the way, a lot of people, when they engage with me, have no clue what their why is. None whatsoever. And so I know right up from the beginning that unless I can help them contact that why inside themselves, and that why is shared enough among the people who need to be involved, that we need to work on the why before anything else. Because these, I mentioned that Agile runs on this different operating system, right? So that means that all of us human beings are going through an upgrade process, which is just not as simple as, you know, upgrading software is today. Think about how hard it was to upgrade operating systems back in the 1990s. It's more like that. It's pretty darn clunky, you know, and Agile is this new app that runs on these modern operating systems, but we install it on top of this old operating system and it runs sort of clunky and we don't know why, right? And so that once we have a sense of why, enough to pull people forward through that internal operating system upgrade, then I have to ask myself the question, can I align with what's trying to happen in the organization?
So David, what was a highlight of this conversation with Lisa for you?
Too many highlights, actually.
It's
hard to choose. It's very hard to choose because it went through some corners of the mind that were very interesting to navigate. But I made a question. I asked her about how she was able to determine when a company is ready to engage with her. And and the question is quite important because I said to her, I think offline, is that something that I always admire of her is that she always is in control of the frame of the conversation. Yeah. And that is quite important because if you may have the best solution for your client, for your customer, but if you are not able to put to direct the conversation, focusing on what the customer needs and how to fix or to deliver the value the customer needs, but navigating that conversation and going through it is so important. And yeah, what she says is so nice. She says that, what is the why that person wants to engage with me? Mm-hmm. She's speaking in terms of she being the coach. Mm-hmm. So why this company wants to engage with me as a coach? But in general, why a customer wants to, a person wants to engage with my services? And determine the why, as she says. And if the why is strong enough to pull the customer through their hard times, mm-hmm. that will happen when you start implementing the solution for them, because right. hard times will come.
Yeah.
I mean, not necessarily because I am not delivering, or I as a service provider, I'm not delivering things, because maybe the organization is being in that situation is not easy. Yeah. So is the why good enough to go through that? Because at the end of the day, what we want is everybody happy here.
right.
A fair exchange of values. We are going to give the value of the solution the company needs. So so that conversation, that part was very nice, I think. Finally, we ended about how to deal with naming the situation. When you're in a very difficult conversation, very emotional conversation, how, and in a professional context, how do you go about that? I like that. Let's name the situation. So let's articulate what is going on. Mm-hmm. What are the things that are happening, the contexts, the repercussions of not reaching an agreement, that kind of stuff. So good episode about about being happy in a business. How to be happy in a business.
Yeah, it was a great conversation with Lisa. And if you watch the video of that episode, you see me kind of looking down a lot while she's talking. That's because I'm furiously taking notes throughout the episode on personal and professional levels. There was so much that I got out of this, and she is very good at reframing things. One funny thing that happened that was not in that episode is that was actually the second time that we attempted to record that episode with Lisa, because the first time there were a variety of technical glitches. And we reached a point where we kind of gave up basically and said, let's try this another day. But what something she did in that was really interesting. Another good example of how she resets conversations and sort of controls the framework is after having a glitch where our recording dropped out and then we got back together in the tool, she said, hey, I want to teach you something, because you know we're all in this remote world now and we're on virtual meetings so many times, and there's so many times where something does happen in the tooling, right? And you do have a scenario where the connection drops and now our thought process has been interrupted. We've got to start over again. And that's very disruptive and can be hard, especially if you're trying to have a very collaborative conversation, right? So when we got back in the tool, she said, I want to teach you something. And what I want you to do is all of us are just going to take two breaths. And so you and I did with her, and we took two deep breaths with her. And then after the kind of resetting our minds that way, she said, okay, now what is the most important thing for us to discuss next? So instead of, you know, having this brutal interruption to the conversation and then just trying to re-pick up where we were and losing all this time, you know, she said, well, what is the most important thing for us to do right now? And it was a great sort of philosophical response, a great agile coach type of response too. Okay, given all the stuff that just happened and we just lost half of our meeting time to technical problems, what's the most important thing for us to do with this time left? And let's reset a little bit. And I loved that aspect of the offline conversation that behind the scenes that no one saw in the actual episode itself. That's a wrap on our first season of the Scaling Tech Podcast. What did you think of this experience so far, David, building up this podcast together?
It was scary. But
that's true.
That's true. It was scary. But we had so much fun during the process. The thing I couldn't even anticipate is how much fun we will end up having at each episode. It was really fun. It's a combination of wisdom. I mean, our guests are very smart people, very smart people. I mean, leaders, thought leaders in their industry. And very healthy back and forth. It's about people that actually work. It is not people just thinking abstract ideas disconnected from reality. No, it's people taking the reality and then come up with the abstract useful ideas. So it's a lot of learning, but fun at the same time. So I didn't anticipate that fun part at all. And I am very happy, and that energized me to keep going.
Yeah, no, I agree. This has been a lot of fun, and I hope for our listeners that's shown through in the recordings as well. But the reality is we're just getting started with the Scaling Tech Podcast. I've really enjoyed recording these episodes with you, David, and I think we're both getting a lot of value. I hope our listeners are as well. We're already hard at work on recording future episodes, but we'd love your feedback from you, our listeners. What did you think about these first episodes of the Scaling Tech Podcast? What can we improve on? Who should we have on as future guests, future topics? To give us your feedback, just hit us up at Scaling Tech Pod on Twitter, on LinkedIn, or contact us via the scalingtechpod.com website. We'd love to hear from you. Please follow us on your favorite podcasting platform to hear more insights about growing and leading your software development team.
Thanks for joining us on the Scaling Tech Podcast, where we help you manage your growing engineering team. Brought to you by agilityfeet.com, experts in staffing engineering teams in Latin America for clients globally. For more information on today's episode and to submit your ideas for future guests, please visit scalingtechpod.com.